Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent, and provocative discussion of issues every week as seen through the lens of sustainability. It is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. It is hosted by Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher, and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, broadcast every week on Otago Access Radio, and podcast on sustainablelens.org and on oar.org.nz.
Our guest tonight is Professor Tim Flannery, a mammalogist, paleontologist, environmentalist, and global warming activist. Our show is hosted by Professor Samuel Mann and me, Shane Gallagher. Professor Flannery was named Australian of the Year in 2007 and until mid-2013 was a professor of Macquarie University and held a Panasonic Chair in Environmental Sustainability. He is the chairman of the Copenhagen Climate Council and International Climate Change Awareness Group. He was the chief commissioner of the Climate Commission, an Australian federal government body, providing information on climate change to the Australian public, which was disbanded by the new right-wing government in 2013. Almost immediately afterwards, he announced that he would join other ASX commissioners to form an independent climate council that would be funded by the community. Professor Flannery is currently a professional fellow at the Melbourne Sustainable Society Institute, University of Melbourne. He started his career as a mammalogist, and his work has earned high praise, prompting Sir David Attenborough to describe him as being in league with the all-time great explorers like Dr. David Livingstone. He has published extensively, but his two most famous books are The Future Eaters, published in 1994, and The Weathermakers, published in 2005. And I literally could go on and on and on talking about Tim's achievements, but we have to stop somewhere, so we should actually stop here and let the man do some talking. Welcome to our show.
Thank you very much. Tim. It's great being here.
So you started off, actually, doing a BA in English and History, I believe.
Yeah, that's right. I was a pretty mediocre student at school, and I was always interested in science, but I didn't do that well in mathematics or languages at school, for a number of reasons for that. But so the only road open to me to go to university, really, was to do humanities. And I did it somewhat reluctantly, I must say. But once I started, I really started to enjoy it. And the privilege of being given 4 years paid, you know, to go to university, because it was back then, to do that, to read the greats in literature and read Spanish colonial history and Portuguese colonial history and those sort of things, was just fabulous. I did love every moment of it. And looking back, I think it was very important, actually, for me as well.
Yeah, and how was it important? Because obviously you're a great storyteller. One of the things I even loved about your books was the titles. You know, yeah. The Future Eaters, yes. the Weathermakers. I mean, the short titles, but amazing titles. They're very evocative. Is that something that you may... Do you think that your BA kind of gave you that sense of storytelling, of narrative?
Well, when I look around at my scientific colleagues and see their training, you get a very different result if you go into a science degree solely. You learn to write in a very particular way that's about conveying information very economically, using jargon, to a very narrow but very experienced audience. And I was just lucky that I read great literature, I guess, because my writing's a little bit different. It's an attempt to reach out to that broader audience rather than just write in that narrow scientific way. So, yeah, I think it was a... It probably was responsible for me being able to break out a little bit and become as much a science communicator as a scientist.
So you said you did your BA reluctantly. So obviously you wanted to do the sciences from young. So tell me a little bit about your childhood and why you wanted to study science.
Well, it's a bit of a mystery in the family, really, even to my mum today, because my dad was an accountant, my mother was a housewife, basically. My sisters weren't interested in science. But somehow or other, I was fascinated with it from a very early age. And I remember finding my first fossils on a local beach at the age of about eight and taking them into the museum and having them identified. And it was this, you know, the formative moment, you know, one of those things you always remember. You can still evoke it in my mind with the smell, the sights, the whole thing is still there. And at that museum that I took the fossils in to be identified, I ended up volunteering. So all the time I was doing my arts degree, I was a volunteer in the museum, working on fossils, learning about science as well. So I spent every spare second I had at the museum really doing that. And going on field trips with people, because through the summer the curator would say, anyone, you know, who wants to put a, you know, go on a field trip I'm doing to Central Australia or Western Victoria, you know, put your hand up. And of course my hand was always up.
That was a pretty important reception you got at that museum. If they had said, oh, it's just a fossil, go away, kid.
Well, exactly. I still remember, I was eight, right? So I had my little shorts on and, you know, I still remember Mum allowed me to take the train into town by myself, which was a half-hour journey, you know, and then to walk up to the museum. And I still remember these stupendous doors, you know, at the back of it. They fitted Brontosaurus through them, you know. And I went in and there was museum guards in those days in the proper old uniforms and very prominent. And I had to go up to one of them and said, you know, I've got this thing. Can anyone help me identify it? So thank heavens the guard, you know, made a phone call. And you know, a few minutes later, a man in a white lab coat came down and took me up this stairwell in this darkened area, past an Egyptian mummy, you know, this is outside the public area, this is behind the scenes, and took me to a whole series of cabinets and opened one up and showed me a similar fossil and said, well, this is what this is. And then he clearly got that I was interested in this sort of stuff. So he said, would you like to see Victoria's only dinosaur fossil? And I was kind of all agog. I didn't even know we had a dinosaur fossil from Victoria. So he opened another drawer and there was a little claw bone about, well, as long as your thumb, I suppose. And he pulled that out and put it in my hand. And it was like this, I can still see it there in my palm of my hand, you know. And it was like this amazing wow moment. And then he took it back and put it in the drawer. And I floated out, you know. And I don't know to this day, though, whether the guy in the lab coat was the curator of fossils or the local cleaner. He could have been either, but whoever it was, he got to change my life.
That's incredible that one moment suddenly just changed the direction of your life. I mean, they can see the emotion in your face and you hear it in your voice. It's like, and this availability of science that being able to reach out to the community is really, really, really important. Is that something that you've taken with you through your career?
Very much so. In fact, I've always been more a museum person than a university person. I used just by virtue of my employment and interests. And the thing I love about museums is that reach into the community. So even when I was director of the South Australian Museum and running a place, if the opportunity arose to talk to a kid about what they were interested in, I would always grab it. You know, even if I was walking through and seeing some kids looking at the exhibits and things, just take the time and talk to them. It can be hugely important, I think.
So you grew up in Melbourne, yeah. And so what was childhood like there? For you, what was it like, apart from going to visiting museums?
Well, my mother and father had moved about as far from the city centre as they needed to be able to get cheap land. So I grew up on what was then the edge of the suburbs at a place called Sandringham. And as my earliest memories of the area were just delightful native bush with birds in it and lizards and amazing place to make cubby houses and things like that. You know, so I must have been perhaps four or five, I don't know. And the beach was right next door. And it was a wonderful place. And by the time I was about 12, it had really been developed. I mean, the suburbs had rolled out through it. And it was really appallingly treated. I remember that some of the swamps where I used to catch frogs and things just filled in with rubbish to become industrial estates. And our local beach, which had a most magnificent sea cliff on it, just became the local municipal rubbish dump. There was car bodies dropped into the ocean and refrigerators. And I remember walking along the beach there with all the oil and gunk just floating off into the ocean, thinking, this is not right. And I asked my mother about it, you know, why all this was happening, and she said, oh, well, that's progress. And I decided then progress was a pretty bad thing. I didn't really want to have much to do with it.
So you went to university, then you got your BA, and you then went to do a master's degree, and you did that in?
At Monash University, so it's in the same city, basically. Yeah. But what had happened was I'd got to the end of the arts degree. I'd realised I had to get a job at that point. The only job really available was teaching. I spent one afternoon with a class in a pretty rough suburb, year nine, you know, 15-year-olds, and realised I was just out of school myself, basically. I thought, there's no way I can do this, nor do I want to do it. You know, it's just so difficult. So in despair, I went to the curator of fossils who I was volunteering for, and he said, well, you know, there's a mining boom on at the moment. There's not enough geologists. Why don't you throw your hat into the ring and see if you can do a geology degree? So I went to Monash, and thankfully that was the truth. They needed people in geology, and they said, if you do some catch-up courses, we can enroll you in a master's, which is what I did. And that was life-saving, really. I was able to get into the science that I wanted to do.
So become a geologist, and then so what happened straight after that? Did you get into mines, or?
Well, no. I met as I was probably halfway through my master's degree, I met a professor from the University of New South Wales, and we had a chat about things. And he said, "Why don't you come up to University of New South Wales when you finished your master's and do a PhD in zoology?" Which is what I did. So I ended up with a PhD in zoology, and again, promptly unemployed at the end of it, you know, but this time with a young baby, 3 weeks old, kind of nightmare situation, really. But I put my hat in the ring for a job, which was really the only job in the country I wanted. It was a scientist at the Australian Museum in Sydney, a curator of mammals. There was 200 applicants, I learnt later. Well, thank heavens I didn't know at the time. I would have been twice as nervous. But I went in and was interviewed and got the job. And that was fantastic. I mean, they gave me a desk. They gave me what I now look back on as quite a humble salary, but it looked to me to be a princely sum at the time. And just said, you go for it. Do your hardest. Do whatever you want. And I wanted to get out into the Pacific Islands, and cross that frontier, really, into those different tribal societies and have a look at mountains which were very poorly surveyed for mammals and so forth. And I found I had to raise some grant money, so I wrote grants to places like National Geographic Society, and that was it. I was off and had 20 years, marvellous years, doing survey work in the Pacific Islands.
And you discovered a lot of species, described species for the first time, and you have a bat, I believe, that's named after you?
That's right. Well, that was the extraordinary thing. When I started that project, I thought, maybe I'll be lucky enough to discover a new species of a small rat or something that's been overlooked by all these great explorers of the past. It turns out that the small mammal fauna was pretty well known. It was the large mammals that were not known. And the reason for that is they're fairly rare, and you have to actually go up with the local tribespeople into the mountains and spend weeks there tracking these things down. It's a bit probably like the Takahe in New Zealand, These are rare, large, charismatic megafauna that have remained elusive and unknown in the mountains. And the people hadn't done that before because the tribes hadn't been what they call pacified. There was still a fair chance you'd get an arrow through the rib cage if you went up into these areas. So that had started to change by the time I started doing my work. And it was possible. There was a little window where you could go out with these people, these very experienced hunters, and learn about these animals. So that's what I did. And we found probably 30 new species of mammals, which is surprising. It's about 10% of New Guinea's mammal fauna was unknown, And they include things like tree kangaroos. We discovered 4 species of tree kangaroos, bandicoots, bats, possums, giant rats, wallabies, a whole lot of things that were unknown.
That must have been just an incredible experience.
It was unbelievable. It really was. I mean, trekking to, flying into an area, going to a village, then trekking up to the top of a mountain and getting into this beautiful alpine habitat and finding it was full of large mammals that had been undiscovered, undescribed, was astonishing.
And just last week also, a new rat?
That's right, yes. We managed to – that's probably the most recent thing that I discovered. And I've been chasing that rat for 30 years. It's an island giant, a large rat, unique to the island of Manus, a very distinctive animal. But also highly endangered. And I had done my best to see if I could locate it. I couldn't. Other people had gone up and done the same. Finally, someone who was studying goannas managed to get an individual. And we were over the moon with that. We thought, great, we'll just keep going. A colleague of mine, who's probably the world's best rat trapper, went up there, found nothing. So this is a really rare rodent. So we named it Rattus detentus because it had been detained, or its ancestors had been detained on Manus Island, and also we were very well aware of the plight of the detainees there and wanted...
A slight subversive name then.
Yeah, just to let people know they hadn't been forgotten, really. What can a scientist do with that sort of stuff? Not much, really, but that was an opportunity. And that name will be there forever. So, they will be remembered.
Is that a... a scientist's allowed to be slightly political in that way?
Well, if you don't ask, it's the best policy. But on this occasion, the name got through and it's there now, so that's it.
Should Boaty McBoatface be called Boaty McBoatface?
If the people want it, I'm firmly of the view they should get it. You know, it's one of the themes of my life, really. I suppose I'm a bit of an iconoclast in that way. I remember joining the Anarchist Society at university. I don't like power structures. Even though I've been director of a museum, which sounds kind of weird, I think that there is true wisdom in the people, and if you can tap into that wisdom, you will achieve great things as a society.
So you then, you're a mammalogist, and you're still obviously working in that field, but then you got involved in climate change. How did that come about?
Well, I was very happy at the museum doing my survey work, and I was offered a position at Harvard University for a year, and I decided I'd take that. I thought being at the centre of academic learning would be fantastic, as it was. While I was at Harvard, I got a phone call from South Australia. They were looking for a director for the museum there, and I said, well, might as well give that a go. And the reason for that really was that I felt I'd had 20 good years. When I thought about it, I'd had, you know, 20 great years doing my own work. I could see the museums were in trouble. Staff were shrinking everywhere. Their capacity was declining. And I thought, well, maybe it's time to give something back. So I put up my hand to be director. I got the job. And it was really through that process of engaging with the South Australian government as kind of one of the leading academics in the state that I became aware, really, of this huge challenge of climate change issue was.
I'm just going to circle back a bit to the Future Eaters. What inspired you to write that book? And what, when you talk about the Future Eaters, what do you mean? What's that phrase mean?
Well, I used the phrase because the people of Australia were really the first people to start eating their future, eating into the capital that was needed to sustain them in the longer term. And it seemed to me a spectacular manifestation of the nature of what it means to be a human in Australia. The book came about from 15 years, probably, of questions that I just couldn't answer. You know, I remember asking my PhD supervisor, you know, why is it that in this country the biggest native carnivore we've got, you know, left is the Tasmanian devil, which you could fit in your bread box, whereas, you know, in Europe there's 330 million people and there's still two species of bears surviving. What is it about Australia that is like? Why have we got so many reptiles, you know, compared with other places? And why are the trees the way they are? Why don't we have deciduous trees? Why do the trees have these sickle-shaped leaves, you know, gum trees and these? Mm-hmm. And not only the eucalypts, but even the wattle trees and many unrelated kinds of trees all have this weird sickle-shaped leaf. No one could answer the questions. And I remember thinking about it. I thought maybe it's the climate, and I went through a whole lot of stuff with that, or the prehistory, fire. None of it panned out. And I remember waking up one night about, must have been one in the morning, and this thing flashed in my mind. It was the soils. It's the soils. And once I had that, everything started falling into place, and I thought, wow, this is really interesting. If Australia's soils are the key determinant of shaping life and evolution on the continent, then there's a big story to tell here. And it turned out to be true that it was our very impoverished ancient soils that were driving evolution in a particular way, affecting everything, not just animals and plants, but human societies as well. And I found that was I just had to tell that story. I thought it was worth revealing that view of what it really is like to be, well, an Australasian, actually, because the book is about Australia, New Zealand, New Caledonia and New Guinea.
And that was a little bit controversial, the theories you put forward, you know, the idea that the first humans were future eaters. But then you also commented about the next generations of immigrants, like the New Zealand Maori when they arrived in New Zealand, and then the Western wave of immigration to Australia. And they followed the same pattern of eating the future.
That's right. A lot of people hated the book. Anthropologists hated it. They felt that I was denigrating Indigenous people by suggesting they had a big impact on the landscape. A lot of business people hated it because I was suggesting Australia had a limited future, that it would never be an Antipodean United States, you know, this gigantic country with hundreds of millions of people, that it was inherently limited by the nature of its soils and productivity. So, there was a big pushback from various people against the book, but I felt it was true, and I felt I just had to tell a story.
So what makes you want to tell these stories? What drives you? What motivates you to do this? Because you seem like you're quite driven. Where does that come from?
There's something, I don't know, there's something in my personality. I've I do think about those difficult questions, and I tend to do it from a first principles basis, and I don't know why, but I can't just live in Australia without understanding the place. You know, I've got to know about why the trees have that leaf shape. I have to really have to know about it, you know. I don't know. It's like when I travel overseas, I can't rest unless I can say a few phrases of the local language. You know what it's like? You've got to have some in. And some of those questions are big and complicated, and they do take a long time to work through, but I'm very happy doing that. I'm happy picking away at that puzzle, like doing a giant jigsaw, I suppose, that no one's ever done before, you know. And once I come to a view and I've tested it and tried to make sure it holds up and stacks up, then I'm confident to stick by it. I'll always be testing it. I'll always be trying to prove myself wrong. But I'm pretty convinced that my view then is robust. I'm happy to defend it in public. So that's a process, I guess, of putting yourself in the world. And that's for some reason, that's what the way my mind works and the way I am.
Because it is, it's quite hard to put yourself out in the world. It's quite hard to make a controversial statement, publish a controversial book like Future Eaters. I mean, did you know people were not going to like that book when you published it?
No, I had no idea, really. I thought I was writing a more kind of academic textbook or something for people who are interested in the nature of Australia. But it had a broader impact than that. I was surprised, really, at the vehemence of some of the criticism. And I was surprised by the fact that it wasn't based on a scientific approach of trying to destroy the argument, but simply a pushback or rejection of the idea. So, but that's the way the world is, I guess.
And then the next controversial book, of course, was the big one, was Weathermakers.
Yeah.
2005, that was 11 years later.
That's right, yeah. And that came out of a very long period of research as well, about 5 years of research.
It was an incredibly influential book. Did you, when you were publishing it, did you again think that it was going to be as influential and as controversial as it was?
Not really, no. You know, when I took the idea to my publisher, he said, oh, there's plenty of books on climate change. Why do you want to write another one? And I said, well, nobody's really told the story in full yet. Nobody has explained in a way that people can understand what this is actually about. And that's what I set out to do. So I had to read all of the back issues of Nature and Science and TELUS and the other journals, try to distill the scientific findings into some kind of crystalline form that was understandable by the public but still truthful to the original research. Faithful to the original research, and then put it all together in a story, really, of human impacts on this very complex climate system of the Earth. It was one of those, you know, global successes, probably the most successful book I've ever written. But again, just, you know, had a huge backlash against it. There was one guy actually wrote his own book trying to take apart the Weathermakers. You know, it's longer than the Weathermakers. It found a few errors, but thankfully not many. And I guess in any work of that size, you have to accept that you'll make some mistakes, and that's fine. I'm grateful.
But that's the nature of science.
It is, absolutely. You don't progress if you don't. And, you know, so that was one thing. But, you know, there was a much nastier backlash than that too. Once climate change became a political issue in Australia, you know, it seemed that it was no holds barred. So all of a sudden there was radio shock jocks talking about my private home, where it was, telling libelous stories about me, sort of slanderous stories about how I was trying to defraud old ladies by buying their waterfront property cheap, you know, by scaring them about rising sea levels and all this kind of inventions, this incredible stuff. And it was really scary there for a while. I had to have federal police protection, actually, for about 4 months at home. So that was pretty tough because, you know, there are nutty people out there who listen to some of these radio shock jocks and can do some nasty things.
Why do you think it got politicised? I mean, it has been politicised in some countries and not others. And for instance, Japan, it's not a political thing. In Germany, it's not a political thing. But it is political in Australia.
Well, there's a lot of interests, economic interests in Australia that are very tied with the fossil fuel industries. I mean, Australia was the Saudi Arabia of coal for a while there. You know, we had a bigger share of the export market for coal than Saudi Arabia does for oil. You know, and, you know, those people had been around, or those industries had been around for well over a century and were very deeply embedded with government and in society. And when they found themselves challenged, they hit back. I think that's just the nature of it. You know, I remember, and they hit back through the means that they normally use, which is more the more right-oriented media, the politicians that are tied to their interests and so forth. You know, there was a while there when I was climate commissioner, you know, I'd walk down the street and you'd hear people, you know, be with your kids, and people would say, oh, there's Mr. Effing Carbon Tax, you know. It was kind of like pretty rough for a while. But, you know, I thought about it, I thought, actually, the reason this is happening is because I'm winning. I'm having an impact. If I wasn't having an impact, none of this would be happening. They just wouldn't be bothering spending any money on it.
And it's that was the thought that got you through this, because it must have had an impact on your family. And
it certainly did. Had a big impact on my kids. You know, I remember my son kind of pleading with me not to do any more of this stuff, because it was only, you know, even he was at university at the time studying geology, and some of the geology professors thought climate change was rubbish. And it's kind of, you know, it's pretty tough, yeah.
There is a notion in geology that we're just looking at the wrong time scale. If you start looking at geological time scales, it doesn't really matter what we do.
Well, that's true, but what sort of argument is that? Where does that leave us as human agents? And where does it leave us in terms of our care for our children and for future generations and for our planet now? I mean, you know, it has to be relevant to us as people and some sort of moral framework that we live in, surely.
So you're trying to explain climate change in a way that people could understand. Is it possible to get people to understand it, or, you know, are we at the stage where people understand it but are pretending it doesn't happen? So no, you know, carrying on explaining it's not going to make any difference.
If I believed that, I'd be doing a different job. I think that keeping explaining it really makes a very big difference, and I've seen that through my life. I mean, just people who I've met who've read The Weathermakers come up to me now and said, look, I embarked on this particular career or this course of study because I read your book and wanted to do something. And some of those people now are heading up significant companies in areas of, you know, sustainable energy and so forth. So it makes a difference, but it takes time. And it's very, very important, I think, to continue doing that. Like I said earlier, I'm a really great believer in the wisdom of just common people. You know, if we can tap into that, into people as individuals and their sense of what's right and wrong, you've done something very profound. And that's what my life's been about. It hasn't been about going into politics and trying to lead people. I've been much more interested in releasing the latent good and capacity in people.
And is that what kind of motivates you as well? Because, I mean, does that drive for knowledge, that's personal, but then it's also this deep set belief in people and our innate goodness. Is that something else that drives you forward? I mean, that must be really hard to keep that belief, and you have people saying these things to you in the streets, and you have these shock jocks, and people doing really horrible things to you and your family, and that must be in a difficult period for you.
Yeah, it was a difficult period, but it didn't shake that belief of mine. For some reason, there is a sort of an unshakable foundation of me as a person. I can't explain why or where it comes from, but it is absolutely central to me and everything I do. And I found that when you reach out to people as individuals, even some of those antagonistic people who are doing that, you get beyond the kind of the facade, the frightened person or the smart ass or whatever it is, and you can reach a real person in there, and that is where the reason and where the goodness lies, is in those individual people. So it's a matter of touching that and unlocking that is key, I think, to any change in society, to anything. It's empowering people with knowledge, you know, reaching them as individuals. That's the important stuff. It's not about political leadership. It's not about parties or about ideologies or anything else. It's actually about somehow unlocking that goodness in individual people and letting that flow upwards into some sort of societal structure, if you want, or societal shape that then gives meaning to all of our lives and makes things better for all of us.
What do you do when you're busily talking about human impacts on the climate system and somebody in the back of the room stands up and starts talking about sunspots or ice caps melting on Mars or something, some tiny piece of the story, but for them that is evidence that the whole lot is not right?
Yeah. Well, look, I usually say, you know, thank you for your question, your comment. I'm not an expert on sunspots or what's happening on Mars, but I can tell you, you know, looking at the science I've studied, that they're small impacts. They're there, but they're small impacts on a very big and complex system. And you've got to treat them with dignity, those people, and really engage in a dialogue. The fact that they're there, they've come to your talk, that they're asking a question, that's really important. And I think that it is important to make them feel that's been worthwhile. You've made an effort to answer their question.
So we're now consistently past 1.2 degrees warming, well, the last couple of months anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
Some of that is an El Nino possibly effect, but we're in that kind of range of things. And given that we're working on a big lag system, does this mean we're done for?
Well, you can never say that you're done for, but you know what the reality is that we are now committed by virtue of the greenhouse gas that we've already put into the atmosphere for temperatures to reach about 1.5 degrees by the middle of the century. So we're getting into the danger zone there, and this El Nino has done us a favour in a way because it spiked temperatures by about a third of a degree. It's giving us a little window into the future so we can see what a world at 1.2 degrees is looking like. And I bet you there's people here in Dunedin who are saying, actually, this looks pretty good. Look at that sunshine out there. It's great autumn weather that we're having here. Maybe this is a good world to be in. But just look northwards to the Great Barrier Reef in Australia. You know, we've just learnt that it's 93% of it's bleached. This bleaching event's been six times larger than anything ever seen before. You know, it's massive and long-lasting consequences from that on the reef ecosystem. The Arctic ice is at its all-time winter low, you know, as well. So the world is changing. And the thing to remember about this is we might be enjoying a great autumn here in Otago now, given current temperatures, but climate change is a process. It's not a destination. You know, it's a process of change. And 1.2 degrees will transform to 1.5 degrees and to 2 degrees and to 4 degrees if we don't do something about the driver.
It's difficult to make the link between the great summer and autumn that we're having to the increase of in floods, particularly when we're really reluctant to say this particular storm event is because of climate change, because it's not. It's the frequency of them. But because we're not prepared to make that link, people aren't able to build that whole story.
Look, I think you're quite right that until recently we haven't been able to attribute individual weather events to climate change, but that's changed over the last 18 months or so. And what scientists have done have said, let's look at, say, that flood event and ask the question of how likely it would be that that would occur were greenhouse gases back at their traditional levels, their original levels. And you can do that and do thousands of computer runs. And for events in Australia that I'm familiar with, like the heatwave of 2012, 2013, you know, the answer comes back that event, the chances of it occurring are about 1 in 12,000 without the human greenhouse gases. Once you put in the human greenhouse gases, it becomes a very, very likely event. So scientists are now willing to say that event would not have occurred had it not been for human greenhouse gas pollution. And that's a big breakthrough. It is linking individual weather events to the cause. And it's important for people to understand. It's important more of that science is done.
So what do we do about it? Are we going to get there by turning the lights off?
This is a collective action problem. It is something the whole world needs to act on together. New Zealand or Australia are relatively small players, although Australia's the 15th largest polluter on the planet. You know, we're significant. New Zealand's much, much smaller than that. So we need to work together on that. And the Paris meeting was a real breakthrough. You know, for the first time we got a strong global agreement. And over the next towards the end of April, countries will ratify that agreement. It'll come into existence and we will start seeing some actions. But that's the big picture. That's important that we can all move in unison together. But the capacity of any society to do anything about this is driven by passionate individuals. And it's really important for those people, whether they're engineers who are pursuing energy efficiency, town planners who are looking at how better to manage emissions at the city level, or, you know, people into recycling. I mean, all of that stuff's important. Or lawyers who are looking at things like a carbon tax, you know. We need that drive to come from society to enable each of the countries under that Paris Agreement to drive emissions down as fast as possible. My personal view is that's not all we need to do. That's going to be very important, but we're going to need to get some of the gas out of the air, and that's going to involve the development of a whole series of new technologies over time, probably, you know, over 20, 30, 40 years.
I think you partly answered this next question, but a lot of people seem to think, you know, especially the ones that don't really want to do anything about climate change, saying technology will get us out of this. Mm. Technology won't get us out of this mess. most by itself, will it?
Well, no, technology is a tool. Yeah. It's like, you know, you've got to have the tool, right? You've got to have the spanner if you want to fix the car, right? But having the spanner alone is not enough. You've got to have the knowledge of how to use the spanner, and you've got to have the will to actually employ it, pick it up and use it. So we need all of those things. So we need the technology. We need the willpower. We need the right regulatory structures and the right enabling circumstances in society for all this to happen.
Are those sort of tools for pulling carbon out of the air, either by not putting it there or by... You're talking sucking it out of various forms. Is that a green myth? Is that sort of, there's this solution just on the horizon? And is that, are people interpreting that as we can carry on having this party?
Yeah, well, it's an excellent question. It's the one we need to answer. From where we stand now in 2016, there's two things that are very clear. I think one is that we have to reduce emissions as quickly, as hard and fast as possible, no matter what happens, whether we develop these new tools or not. The second is that we don't really know at the moment whether those tools have the capacity to draw CO2 out of the atmosphere at the scale needed. I mean, at the moment, humanity's putting about 50 gigatons of CO2 equivalent into the air every year. Now, if you wanted to, say, plant trees to take 5 gigatons out of the atmosphere per year, you'd need to plant an area larger than the size of Australia. I mean, you know, this is a very large-scale problem. So, you know, can we manufacture carbon fibres from atmospheric CO2 at a scale that'll make a difference? Because that's a technology that's already out there, you know, but a very small scale. Manufacture plastics from atmospheric CO2. It's another possibility. Make green concretes, carbon-negative concretes. Can we use silicate rocks to draw CO2 out of the atmosphere? Can we use seaweed farming to do the same thing at scale? Now, we know all of these things are possible at a very tiny laboratory scale or experimental scale, but are they applicable at the gigaton scale? And that's the question that we need to answer between now and 2050 if we're to have a hope of any of these technologies reducing the scale of the problem we face.
See, that's my problem with climate change, is that the scale of the problem is going to need the scale of the solution at that scale, which is just more essentially industrial development, which is what got us into this mess. And that is only fixing the climate change problem. Industrial development at that scale is going to make extinctions worse and all the other sorts of stuff we're doing. So is because we're focusing on climate change, are we actually making everything else worse?
Well, let's look at the practicalities of a couple of those approaches. One of them is seaweed farming, you know. Seaweed farms are great places to grow protein, to grow fish and shellfish and so forth, because the kelp buffers the acidity of the ocean. There's plenty of Central Pacific Ocean out there that is a biological desert. You could have floating seaweed farms on and feed the world with you know, cheap, high-quality protein. And capture lots of CO2. Now, if we could cover 9% of the world's ocean in seaweed farms, we could draw down all of the current emissions, all 50 gigatons we put up every year, which is an amazing thought. Now, 9% of the world's ocean's a big area, right? It's 4.5 times the size of Australia. But over time, we might be able to achieve a portion of that in a way that's not just creating more industry, but feeding a hungry world and drawing down CO2 at the same time. Another example of that is the manufacture of carbon fibres from atmospheric CO2. I mean, at the moment, the manufacture of carbon fibres emits CO2, right? So we're talking about a new process that's cheaper than the conventional one that draws CO2 out of the atmosphere. Carbon fibres are the strongest, lightest material, you know, that we know of in many instances. It competes directly with steel and aluminium. So if you can take the problem, atmospheric CO2, and turn it into a solution that competes with other really polluting industries, you've done something pretty major. So these are where the technological advances are potentially taking us. It's not just into a more industrialised, dirtier future. It's to a replacement for some already dirty processes and thinking differently about the world in ways that might make a difference.
So that sounds a little bit like sustainable, you know, business models. What's your definition of sustainability, or do you have one, a working definition?
Well, a working definition is at least one that, to the best of our knowledge at the moment, isn't creating more problems than it solves. You know, that would be my best effort at the moment with it. But it is, you know, some of these outcomes are unknowable. Who would have guessed that the, you know, CFCs would have caused the ozone hole? You know, there's always unknowables out there or uncertainties. But you have to move forward. You can't be paralysed by that uncertainty.
Can we have sustainable growth?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, it depends on for how long and how much growth and so forth. But, yeah, we need to. In the sense that there's, you know, a billion people out there who are living in abject poverty who need betterment of quality of life. So we have to have at least enough growth to give them a decent standard of living. And the population is going to continue to grow out till 2050 or so. So we need to discover the model that gives us that, at least in the short term.
Was limits to growth right?
No, I think it was wrong. Only in the sense... It was the general sentiment was right, but what was wrong was that people thought we would run out of resources. It turns out that there are actually lots of resources, and particularly mineral resources and so forth. You know, the volume of resources you have is proportionate to the amount of energy you're willing to put in to get them back. So you can chase resources into poorer and poorer quality deposits and so forth. The big limits to growth, it turns out to be the rubbish bin. You know, Earth's rubbish bin that we were using, the oceans and the atmosphere, that's the real limit. And once the rubbish bin got full, you know, we're drowning in our own waste. And that's, I think, something that people didn't foresee.
We're talking mostly here about what we're doing at a sort of a personal level and about tools and technologies. But do we really need a cultural, political change?
I really think that we do. We need a big political change. You know, the current political system that we're working under is the end result of at least 1,000 years of continuous change and contest in places like the United Kingdom, you know. And it still entrenches privilege. It disenfranchises people. It perverts the will of the people. We need a different system, and I think we can get one. And can I give you a bit of a vision of where I think we might be going
that
might solve these problems? You know, if you could imagine a situation where politics is not a career as such, but is a public service that people do who are well respected in the community, who are willing to stand up and say, I'll be your representative for one term, right? I'm not going to come to you with any policies, because what I want to do is to tap into your wisdom and knowledge about things for you to help formulate responses. So I'm going to be cheap to run. I'm not going to have entitlements, as they're called in Australia for politicians. I'll just be up there for one term formulating questions that we need to answer now. And we're going to put those questions to you as a people using a jury system. So we'll randomly choose 30 or 40 people, expose them to all sides of an argument, on whether it's a budget debate or whatever else, and then let you decide, you know, within limits, because we don't want to shock the system, what needs to be done. And that, I just think if you do that, you would get such a revolutionary change. It's an uncorruptible system in a sense, because representation is so fragmented. It's, you know, each one of us becomes a representative of our constituency, of our community, for a very short period over a small issue. And that's an uncorruptible system. And that's what we need. We need a system like that. The big problem we've got at the moment is career politicians who end up serving self-interest or their parties above the people. And we need to change that.
And being perhaps quite happy with the apathy of the people.
Exactly. But people are not really apathetic, you know. But, I mean, we're used to the idea of jury systems for the legal system, which is great. But can you imagine a day when each one of us would know what it's like to serve on a jury to decide what the size of the defence budget should be, or how the health budget should be used, or what an aspect of foreign policy should be like? You know, having engaged in something, if we've all done a bit of it, we have a bit more respect for the decisions made by juries elsewhere. And I think that's where we need to go. You know, it's old Adam Smith, you know, with the Division of Labour. Very, very intelligent man when he wrote The Wealth of Nations. Talking about the virtues of the division of labour and having specialists. And it works in almost every area of human life and enterprise except politics. It's the one area where you don't want a division of labour. It's the one area where we all actually have to pull our weight as citizens if we want to have a decent and just and prospering society.
So you mentioned anarchistic tendencies. How are we going to get there while we have politics that's dominated by big money, big oil?
Well, what we need to do is have people stand up who are respected by their communities and say, I will stand at the next election to represent you. I'm not going to accept any campaign financing or anything like that. I'm not going to stand there with any ideologies. I want you to tell me how we respond to this through this jury system. I'm only going to be there for one term. And I think that would be profoundly disruptive. I'd vote for someone like that. I think there's lots of people out there who would vote for someone like that.
Would you be Prime Minister under something like that?
Well, would you need a Prime Minister is the question. You know, you'd probably need a Speaker of the Parliament. You'd need someone to give some order. But because in that system, power has been given back to the people in order to gain authority, there's an open question there as to whether you need a Prime Minister or not. You might need some sort of titular head of the country, but maybe in that situation a Prime Minister is not the powerful person they are today. It's someone who is much more representative, perhaps, or emblematic.
We're writing a book about these interviews, calling it Tomorrow's Heroes. So what would you like your sustainable superpower to be?
Sustainable superpower? Mm. No, if I was a kind of superpower being?
Yeah.
Empathy.
What's the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
Wow, well, that's a hard question. Probably still too early to tell. but certainly the establishment of the Climate Council, which was adopted by the people of Australia and was really given to the people of Australia, you know, was a big thing. I think that's probably a step. It's taught me a lot, that process. It's taught me a lot about the sort of structures that work and how you actually engage people in a big enterprise like this.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
No, I don't see the world in those terms, you know. So I think it's a bit like it's a bit like the political system. See, activist almost it entails with it an idea that there is a power out there, there's an authority that we're kind of fighting back against, you know. And my world paradigm is not like that. I think that the big decisions, the important decisions, need to be made outside the political system. And there's a role for leaders outside that political system to engage in dialogue and influence the public dialogue about things. It's just that shouldn't be happening in the political system. That happens outside it. The political system is should be a deliberative system that comes down to hard decisions made about the big public issues of the day by juries, not by politicians, but by juries of ordinary citizens. So I don't think I'm an activist. I think I'm maybe a public intellectual, is maybe a bit more like what I think of myself being.
Now, I'm going down my list of questions that we end with, and you've possibly already answered this. In fact, we actually asked this question explicitly, but I'm going to do it again, give you another shot at it. What motivates you?
Oh, that's a good question. Look, I think it's curiosity, first and foremost, about the nature of the world. And it's also always had this view that we need to leave the world a better place than we found it. And the only way to do that is to really understand the world and how it works. I find it a paradox in me because I've lived through a period where the world has self-evidently got worse in so many ways over my lifetime. We've seen extinctions and all sorts of things happening in the environment. And yet I still have this belief that we need to leave the world a better place than the way we found it. So I don't know how to explain that, but that it is just a profound conviction I have. So that's important. Real faith in human nature and people. I think that, you know, that is the only resource ultimately that it's the most important resource we have as our fellow human beings. And unlocking the full potential of ordinary humans to engage in the world and determine their own fate in a wise, consultative way is just so central to what we are as a species. So they're probably the driving things, I think.
What challenges are you looking forward to in the next couple of years?
That's a very good question. I'm looking forward to staying fit and healthy for as long as I can. I'm looking forward to re-engaging in the Pacific Islands. I've just established two community projects in the Solomon Islands trying to foster community conservation, which is really the most important kind of conservation in those island societies. You know, government is weak. There's lots of loggers who want to get in there and destroy forests. You've got to start empowering communities and giving them something in exchange for protecting forests and biodiversity. So that's been a marvellous process, really. I've really enjoyed it. It's reinvigorated me. And it's sort of, it's like, I reckon it's like for a woman putting on that lipstick in the morning. You know, you do that and you look great. You look $1 million. Well, climate change is one of those things where you just can't go and put the lipstick on in the morning. It just, it's too long a process. There's very few moments where you say, we've won or we've done something. But the Pacific Islands work is great because it is. It's kind of like, wow, there we are. We've already got some success. It's sort of small enough scale. You can see it build. So there, I'm looking forward to those challenges. The rest of it is going to be a slow grind. I'll be an old man before we get to the point where we can say we've overcome the problem, if I'm lucky enough to live that long, for climate change, that is.
Are there more books in the works?
Yeah, there is. I wrote a work of fiction last year, which was I found immensely satisfying. It was interesting. There'll be some more books, I think. I'm interested at the moment in Europe. Much underestimated place, I think, and full of intriguing questions. Why is it that that little appendix of Eurasia became a dominant superpower by the 19th century? And what's that all about? That's pretty fascinating stuff.
If you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur by tomorrow morning, what would it be?
What would it be? A miracle. Having grown up as a Catholic, I should be used to that sort of concept. But I'm struggling at the moment to think what the miracle might be. I think I would. The miracle for me would be to have us on a downwards trajectory of about 3 parts per million atmospheric CO2 per annum. That would be my miracle. So a slow readjustment of the system back to where it needs to
be. And what's the smallest thing that we could do that would have the biggest impact to get us there?
Get engaged with a group of like-minded citizens, because anything that we achieve is achieved together, really, in this area. And those community groups like the Climate Council are just, they're very powerful.
And that's awesome advice, but I'm going to ask another question. Do you have any advice for our listeners?
Well, I remember one of the most influential things ever said to me was an old German fellow when I was director of the museum in South Australia, who said, "You're a long time staring at the lid." That's right. Get out there and do something. Don't waste any time.
Excellent. Okay. You're listening to Sustainable Lands on Otago Access Radio, 105.4 FM. The show was recorded on the 22nd of April, 2016. Our guest was author and climate change activist, or not activist, Professor Tim Flannery. Your host, Professor Samuel Mann, and me, Shane Gallagher. You can get podcasts of previous shows at sustainablelands.org, where you can get subscribe in iTunes or on oir.org.nz. We hope you enjoyed the show.